Good morning. Hello. Just waiting. People keep trickling in. Hi, my name is Emily Weiss, and I first just want to thank you all for choosing this session instead of shipping to and from China, because I thought that sounded pretty cool. But anyway, so thank you for coming. My name is Emily Weiss, and I have been a fine art insurance broker at DeWitt Stern in New York for almost 5 years. DeWitt Stern has been around for over 100 years, and we do all kinds of insurance, ranging from professional liability to entertainment. And we happen to be really well known for our expertise in fine art. So we work with a lot of major galleries and private collections, as well as museums, auction houses, fine art packers and shippers, artists, foundations, estates, and living artists themselves. So basically anyone who touches art, we provide insurance for. So maybe you didn't come all the way to New Orleans just to hear a session on insurance, although maybe you did. But at the risk of sounding totally nerdy, I actually think fine art insurance is pretty fun and interesting. But for you, I think learning how to, or knowing how to navigate your institution's insurance needs is one of the most important jobs you have as a museum registrar or collection specialist. So today I will be doing sort of a little fine art insurance 101. Daria Covey from the New Museum will talk about some exhibitions. Larry Giacoletti from the Noguchi Museum will shed some light on his claims experience. And Steve Pincus, my manager slash mentor, will hopefully leave you with some parting words of wisdom and answer any questions you have. So, a couple years ago, my colleague Mary Pontillo originally put together a version of this insurance handbook. We asked a couple of registrars we work with if they really wanted to hear a session on insurance again, and they all agreed that it's something they could always use a refresher on. So hopefully you all printed this out. It's in the Dropbox. And if not, I suggest you do after, just because it's a really great resource, has a lot of information on insurance terms, and also is a way to keep track of things like your broker, insurance company, limits, deductibles, has some information on how to navigate exhibitions and loan agreements, and also has a lot of information on other coverages that are separate from fine art. So, here are some of the key qualities that differentiate fine art insurance from other kinds of coverages. First of all, these policies cover the physical loss or damage to artwork, not your liability. Policies are written on an all-risk basis, which essentially means that anything is covered unless it's excluded, and I'll go back to that in a little bit. You may also hear the terms wall-to-wall or nail-to-nail, which basically means that art is covered from the time it's taken off the wall at its original location, in transit, whatever it's doing, in a showroom, back to the original wall or in storage. It's really important to note that your policies, you have blanket limits over all named locations in transit and at temporary locations, and that claims are made on a per occurrence basis, not per location. So say you have a policy with limits of $10 million, and one day there's a loss where art is damaged at your museum in Manhattan, as well as your fine art storage facility in Long Island City. Say, I don't know, maybe a huge tropical storm that wipes out all of the five boroughs of New York and New Jersey. I don't know if you all remember that thing called Sandy, but anyways, if something like that happens, a major event, the insurance company would only pay up to, or be able to pay up to, a max of $10 million if those are the limits you have in your policy, as that was one single event, one occurrence. However, for example, say there was a fire at your museum the same day that there happened to be a theft at your storage facility, the insurance company could potentially pay up to $10 million for both of those separate losses, because they're two completely different events. So you, most museums and collections policies have a zero deductible policy. A lot of other commercial, like galleries, would have a deductible. But the purpose of a deductible is basically to make sure that, you know, we like to say you have some skin in the game. So an example would be if you are consistently having transit losses due to the ill-advised usage of FedEx, which please don't use FedEx, the insurance company might slap on a small deductible so that, you know, if this keeps happening, you're going to be responsible for the first $1,000 or $2,500. Also, you might have a higher deductible for a flood or earthquake depending on where you're located. There are different valuations for owned inventory, which is usually the scheduled amount or current market value, versus loaned items, which is usually the agreed amount between you and the lender. Most policies have common conditions. These are things like you need to have items packed by competent packers, which is actually pretty vague. You need to keep adequate records and keep your alarms on and maintained. And lastly, there are specialists involved, such as fine art loss adjusters and appraisers. They understand the kinds of property that you're working with. They know if something can or cannot be fixed and what needs to go into that, whereas a general adjuster might not really know the difference between an encaustic and oil painting. So I mentioned earlier how fine art policies aren't all risk, but we know that's not really 100% true. There are always going to be exclusions. Sorry, I went a slide ahead. So sorry about that. There are always going to be exclusions. And so these are some of the major exclusions on museum and collector policies. And two that I want to point out are damage due to conservation and retouching. So that's important to note when you're sending works out to a conservator or restorer. If there's a fire at the conservator studio, the work is covered. However, if the conservator actually scratches the piece while they're working on it, that would not be covered. And another interesting exclusion is inherent vice, which refers to a quality in the piece that would cause itself to damage or just destroy itself. So an example of that would be like the Damien Hirst shark in formaldehyde. In the fine art insurance industry, these are some of the major players. Obviously, we're starting with you, the insured. You have valuable property and you need to protect it. You can't go directly to the insurance company. You need to go to a broker. So the broker's role is to really evaluate your risk, understand what your insurance needs are, and present that information to the underwriters in the best light possible to get you the best coverage for the best price. So the underwriters, they actually work for the insurance company. They take the information that the brokers give them. They actually take on the risk by providing you with an insurance policy, and they will pay your claims if there's loss. And as I mentioned before, the claims adjusters are the specialists. They would either work for an insurance company or some work independently, but they really understand the materials you're working with, and they know you know, if it's a total loss or a partial loss, and they will figure out how much you should be paid in a claim. All right, so remember that list of exclusions I just went over? You want to be really careful that when you're lending artwork out, that you want to really look at the borrower's list of exclusions and any endorsements that are on their policy that might affect your loan. You know, if you have a policy that's really broad and you have this great fine art collection policy and you have terrorism coverage, you want to make sure that when you're loaning it out that your borrower also has terrorism coverage. You know, just because you're lending artwork out doesn't mean that you should not still have the best coverage. And for incoming loans, equally important to really review those loan agreements. You don't want to risk signing off on something and agreeing to things that your insurance company might actually not pay for. So you should really send those. Your broker should be able to review those with you and help you negotiate the terms of the agreement before anything is signed. Because if you do sign something, you will be still held financially responsible regardless of whether your insurance company would actually be able to pay for that. So if that happens, your CFO is going to come looking to you, and it's not going to be fun. So have your broker help you review those. Some lenders might request that they are named loss payee, and that basically gives them the right for when they have an insurable interest in a piece that they're lending you, if there's loss, your insurance company would be able to directly pay the lender instead of having to remit payment to you first and then you pay the lender. So that's a common request. When you are doing traveling exhibitions, there are three main ways that you can insure those. The first way is that you can increase your primary museum policy limits to accommodate the exhibition. So that might end up being one of the cheaper options, but the problem with that is when you have a traveling exhibition, it's at another venue, and that venue is the reason that damage occurs, that claim is still going to fall under your primary policy, and it's going to affect your claims history and your premiums. So the second way, and my personal favorite, which Derry and I have actually discussed recently, is to do a separate exhibition policy. So this way, you might be working with the same insurance company you already work with. You're going to have all the same benefits of the same coverages, the same loss adjusters. But the difference is that if there was a loss, that is going to fall under the separate exhibition policy, and it will not affect your primary policy's claims history. So I think for those really large exhibitions, that's the best option. And then lastly, you can push the risk off to the borrowing venues and have them insure it, which again is cost effective, but the problem is that you risk not really knowing what their policies are covering. You might have major differences in coverage, and you don't really know how claims would be handled. And then, of course, there are general liability implications, which maybe you're not really dealing with on your day-to-day, but it's still really good to know what to look out for. So an example of that is when the new museum was installing a slide that went through multiple floors, we thought, you know, we should probably check their liability limits, make sure that they have adequate coverage for when that over-eager visitor hurls themselves down the slide and breaks their arm and sues the museum. So on that note, I would like to have Daria Covey come up to discuss. She can elaborate a lot more on that and some other interesting scenarios.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending our presentation today. My name is Daria Covey, and I'm an associate registrar at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. I'd like to share with you some information about the new museum and some examples of how we've shaped our own insurance program. Founded in 1977 with a mission of new art, new ideas, the new museum is Manhattan's only dedicated contemporary art museum and is respected internationally for the adventurousness and global scope of its curatorial program. And I really like the use of the word adventurousness. This is taken straight from our website. And also speaking of that and the example that Emily just brought up, the first artwork I'd like to talk about is from our Carsten Haller exhibition presented in the winter of 2011. Known for works that alter the audience's physical and psychological sensations, inspiring doubt and uncertainty about the world around them, Haller has employed psychotropic drugs, flashing lights, and other stimuli to potentially alter the viewer's mental state. Haller's art takes the form of proposals for radical new ways of living by creating sculptures and diagrams for visionary architecture, as well as transportation alternatives, such as his renowned slide installations. The new museum exhibition included one such slide, which started in our fourth floor gallery and ended on the second floor. This exhibition also invited visitors into a water sensory deprivation tank titled Giant Psycho Tank, and inundated them with blindingly bright flashing lights in another gallery. This exhibition was actually before my time at the new museum. I mainly wanted to bring it up as an example of an exhibition where fine arts coverage alone isn't going to cut it. In the end, all museum visitors signed liability waivers upon entering the building, and donned protective helmets and cotton sacks while shooting down the slide. During her intensive residency at the New Museum in the spring of 2014, Janine Olison developed a group of interrelated new works, constituting an exhibition, public programs, workshops, a publication, and a performance in the form of an experimental opera, collectively titled Hear, Hear. In this slide, you can see the exhibition and performance forms of the work. And if you look closely, you'll notice the same items, which were on loan to us by the artist, were used in both: the static display in the gallery and dynamic activation in our theater. Well in advance of Olson's residency, the curator, artist, and exhibition staff, myself included, talked through the logistics of how the objects would move to the theater and back into display in the gallery after the rehearsals and performance were complete. The schedule for the rehearsals and performances was set, and after a month or so on view in the gallery, the items would be turned over to performers for their activation. So here lies the rub. Our standard loan agreement had been executed for these items, and the new museum had committed to ensuring the works nail to nail, which included the time period they would be activated. After considering the risks involved and discussing this with the artist, we came to the agreement that the new museum's insurance coverage would only be in place while the items were on static display. A loan agreement addendum to this effect was executed, including the dates and times of all the rehearsals and performances. The addendum stipulated that the artist was welcome to provide her own insurance coverage as long as the new museum was listed as additional insured or a waiver of subrogation could be provided. After activation was complete, when they were ready to be reinstalled in the gallery, all the items were recondition checked before coming back under the new museum's coverage. Is it possible to archive performance art? How far can a physical record capture an ephemeral experience? Performance Archiving Performance was a presentation of projects from the winter of 2013 that all engaged archive as medium in exploration of these questions. One work on view was the artist's proof of this double-sided knife on loan from the performance artist Lovett Codignone. Technically considered a prop by the artist, the piece is activated by each one of the artists placing it in their mouth simultaneously as they face each other and hold on to each other in what could be called a tango dance pose, their white button-up shirts attaching them together with cufflinks passed down from their family. Similar to the previous example, these items would also be used in rehearsals and performances throughout the course of the exhibition. Unlike the previous example, the logistics of who would be using the knife and when was still being worked out. In this scenario, we came to a similar agreement with the artist that the new museum could only insure the knife while it was on static display in the gallery. When the performers came to activate it, they would need to sign a receipt, officially receiving the knife from the museum, along with all the liability should anything happen while in their custody. One evening, after signing out the knife, the performer was taking the elevator down to the museum theater when the elevator door closed on her hand. She dropped the knife as well as the small cufflinks and had a small cut on her palm. Luckily, she was fine after some basic first aid and all the items were recovered. The cufflinks were fine. However, the knife had substantial bend at one tip due to the force from the drop. It also had some blood residue on it. Since the performer's hand was fine, our curator's priority went to notifying the artist with the regrettable news that the knife had a change in condition. While the museum was fully protected from any liability arising from the incident, in a way it was unnecessary, as the artist who owned the knife, Lovett Codignone, considered the change part of the archive of the object and views it as a physical manifestation and record of the rehearsal process. They never restored the knife or removed the blood. Kind of fortuitous. Named for the projecting piece on a sundial, Gnomons, in this presentation from the spring of 2014, Horvitz grapples with time and standardized measurements and the shifts that occur when natural phenomena are subject to man-made systems and vice versa. Horvitz's presentation at the new museum included the work Let Us Keep Our Own Noon, consisting of 47 handbells created through the remelting of a French church bell dating back to 1742. On the surface, everything with this exhibition seemed pretty straightforward. The bells would be hung on strings above visitors' reach in one of our exhibition spaces. Our standard incoming loan agreement was signed by his gallery, who would officially be lending us the bells. After the loan agreement was signed, we were notified by the curator that the work is actually activated by 47 performers who, at local noon, when the sun is positioned exactly above the new museum, collectively ring the bells in the gallery and then disperse throughout the building and out of the museum and onto the surrounding streets. Once outside, each performer rings his or her own bell while walking away from the museum until no other bell can be heard except for their own. At that point, they turn around and return to the museum to return the bell. Referencing a bygone practice of... sorry. Let's let that sink in there. Referencing the bygone practice of navigating time according to the position of the sun, the work reminds us that our daily rhythms are not solely determined by tradition and locality, but also rooted in global forces. Our curator was currently in the process of recruiting members of the public to sign up as participants in the bell ringing. It was important to us that this element of the performance remain so that we could be true to the artwork. However, the risks introduced by having the bells removed from the building by visitors were too high. If one person or 20 people were to walk away with the bells, how could I call Emily and tell her? Hi, Emily. I need to file a claim for half of an artwork disappearing. Emily, what happened? We let visitors walk out the door with them and they never came back. After discussions with the artist, we all agreed that, similar to my previous examples, the new museum's insurance would only cover the items while on static display and not during the performances. A loan agreement addendum was signed to this effect. The piece was performed multiple times over the course of the exhibition, and I held my breath and crossed my fingers every time. Even though the new museum had no liability in the event of a loss, you know how we collections managers and registrars are. We get very attached to the artworks in our care. In the end, we never had an incident during any of the activations, and every bell was promptly returned. With multiple considerations to bear in mind, including priorities, risks, personalities, and relationships, there's no one-size-fits-all recommendation that can be made. The loan registrar, working together with museum colleagues, insurance advisors, artists, and lenders, can craft the ideal insurance program that protects all parties as well as the integrity of the artwork. Thank you. So now Larry Giacoletti is going to tell us about his experience with the claims process.
Good afternoon. My name is Larry Giacoletti, and I'm the Registrar Collections Manager at the Noguchi Museum. It is a privilege to be here today and actually meet a lot of people face-to-face for the first time outside of emails and phone calls. I only hope I can do this insurance panel justice and tell the Noguchi Museum story properly. I'm sorry that my colleague Mary Plantillo couldn't be here as well. We're both suffering Mets fans at this moment. She obviously is taking it very, very hard. So as you might have guessed, I'm going to be talking about Hurricane Sandy, and I refuse to call it Superstorm Sandy because there's nothing super about it in my books. For those of you impacted by Sandy, especially at the table, of course, there's not a day that goes by, really, that Sandy doesn't come up in some conversation in some point. It's been over three years now, and it still resonates to us. So I'm going to be speaking to preparations that the Noguchi Museum did before, actions during, and, spoiler alert, claims. So not that you weren't that surprised. So let me start by saying that I'm a very lucky registrar. I'm a very lucky person in my position, and I'll explain that in a little bit further down. And since you're all captive audiences, there are a couple people I'd always like to take the opportunity to thank who helped me during the Sandy opportunity. My former administrative director, Amy Howe, who has moved on to a different career, but she was pivotal in helping us in Sandy. Daria also came to our assistance in Astoria. Zach Harper, who's somewhere in this massive group of people. Cindy Albertson and Beth Noonan were conservators, and of course all the entire staff of the museum that pitched in and helped without questions. So basically, going back really quickly, how did the Noguchi Museum design our insurance plan? This obviously was in place before I started there, but it gets tweaked, obviously, every year or so. We always revisit it. And when Amy and Hal and I were sitting down to revisit it the last time, we were sort of approaching it like a collections management policy. I mean, always moving. It's always going to be in flux, basically. There's always going to be changes. It's going to be morphing constantly. And it's always going to be under some sort of scrutiny by some pair of eyeballs, whether it's insurance or internally the board or whatever. So obviously we took into consideration the total values of the artworks, where they're stored, how they're stored. We took into consideration how much movement certain items make in a year. With the Noguchi Museum, since we are sort of it's a location, we don't get a lot of accidental tourists, basically. So people come to the museum and they want to see specific items, and we want to make sure that those items are on view a lot. And when they're not on view, they're going to be coming back relatively soon. Always on view, rarely off, basically. You're always in a state of returning to display. Many other considerations, of course, another consideration is the building. And obviously we talk about buildings as the structure and the protection of the artwork. But in our case, we treat it as a work of art itself, because Isamu was very integral in placing the artwork in the museum, and we try to stick to his aesthetics whenever we have to reinstall pieces itself. So we see the artwork in there, obviously is being very important, but the building itself is actually something we consider a holistic sort of work. As noted in the AXA handbook, I want to mention that sometimes we registrars are not directly connected to the policies of insuring said building. Sometimes we are, sometimes we're not, except for, of course, like Daria mentioned, the general liabilities of sorts. So many items that Heather and Rebecca covered yesterday in the disaster preparedness session, I don't know how many everybody was there to see that one, rings true throughout my talk today. Thanks to Hurricane Irene in 2011, going way back, we actually had an emergency plan in place. It was young, it was untested, but we had something ready, and that was great. And Sandy actually proved a great learning tool in that respect, too. As you can see from this image, this tiny image on the screen, the Noguchi Museum is only a mere 300 yards from the glorious East River. I'm sure Noguchi was not thinking of flood protection when he bought the building, and you probably see where I'm going with this story. There we go. So, October 25th. We're gonna pass over Sandy, and I don't know if anybody here really, I don't necessarily need to see the horrifying images all over again. So October 25th, 2012, AXA sends out this email announcement of impending doom, including the simple and clear pre-checklist, punch list of things to do. This was incredibly helpful. I mean, not only we had the disaster plan, emergency plan in place, but this was just reaffirming all the checklist things we needed to take care of. Our museum's call to action was to begin. We had begin meetings with the facilities people, operations, and of course our director, keeping everyone in the loop on the weather and the forecast and the path and what we're going to do. It was decided that we would close several galleries on the first floor and bring up the priority marked pieces for the safety, most delicate pieces that we had in storage. And at this point, I should mention that we had over 1,000 objects stored in our cellar basement areas. So Monday, October 29th, landfall hits New York City. The first phone calls of water breach were made between our on-site facility staff and Amy Howe. She reported to Mary Pontillo from DeWitt Stern and AFR. The New York Fire Department was contacted as well, but since this wasn't lives were not in danger, we were really, really low on the priority list of things. I know we all don't feel that way, but the fire department sees it in that way. So the communication tree was established at that point. So I think everybody knew that there were going to be claims coming down the road, and also triage of sorts. So Amy, my colleague, was also in reaching out to Karen Moore, DeWitt Stern, about flood insurance. Amy and I set up hourly communications to discuss progress and the state of the building, basically, because it's probably a good time to mention, while this was going down, I was in Japan. So I was, talk about the most helpless feeling in the world of being so far away and not being able to do anything about anything. This is referencing back to my lucky comment as well with the people that I had here and being able to lean on them from so far away. So this photo shows 1 week into dealing with Hurricane Sandy issues. I have returned from Japan. You can clearly see the camera still has the 24-hour clock date stamp on there. To begin the triage, basically. And as you see, the several galleries that we set aside for bringing up the priority artworks have now become, it's become the entire first floor of work. Luckily, we didn't have to claim anything for business interruption because all the businesses in the area were pretty much affected anyway, so nobody was doing business in Long Island City. So that was, I guess, a positive. So the staff, museum staff with assistance from AFR responders brought up the artworks from the storage rooms. And then basically just put them on blotter papers. So 1 week into this, and our claims adjuster appears at the museum to assess the damages. Now you may think 1 week, wow, it took a long time. But actually there was communications happening on a daily basis with the claims adjusters. And because, again, we were not as bad as, say, many of the people like in Chelsea or other institutions like Marie O'Malley and South Street Seaport, they could take their time to get to us. It doesn't sound so bad when they say that they showed up a week after it happened. So there was daily communications. Also on the parade tour through the building, Chubb came through. The claims adjusters came through as well, the National Flood Insurance. So there was a myriad of people sort of trickling through there to check out everything that had happened. My colleague Amy Howe informed me that recently that the claims for the building itself were filed about 2 weeks after landfall. And of course, it goes without saying, at the same time, we had conservation and conservators helping us as well at this time. So this image shows the works laying on the blotter paper. The other one did as well. All affected works were categorized 1, 2, and 3 in terms of their priority levels affected by the East River, quote-unquote, water. Anything that could have been a water affected was brought up. And this is something to consider. In the very front is a piece that was it was broken and discarded by ASAMU in the 60s. But this is something where, without the institutional knowledge going through this with the claims people, they may have thought this was something that was damaged during the flood. And it clearly was not, but it certainly could look that way. I get it. So this is the couple workstations that we set up on the gallery floors to help track conditions and the movement of artworks with the ability to flag trouble pieces. And also proved really helpful to quickly access insurance values and information as many people were passing through the triage rooms, and we needed to get information pretty quickly. And again, speaking to being lucky, the carts, the table, the printer was all set up by my facilities manager as I was returning from Japan. So a lot of this was ready for me when I came back, which was great, actually. This is now one long day of packing finished, but more problems were lurking. So the next slide, yeah, okay. So now these are all the packed objects ready to head up to conservation. Again, at this point, insurance, all the people know that we're going to have a claim coming. There's going to be many claims coming. But we needed to get this stuff to the conservator to get all the details, basically, the estimated costs. And perhaps you'll remember at this time, if you're in the New York area, that this is about the same time as the fuel shortage hit New York City. So trucks were very hard to find. So we had things packed. We had to get them to them somewhere, but we couldn't get them to their locations. They basically set another day or two waiting. And also our conservator's facility was in the old Surround Art building, which was in the Brooklyn Navy Yards, which also got hit really hard too. So it was lemon juice in the wound, basically, for us. So to sum up the actual conservation, we sent about 106 objects. Components were sent to conservation, basically, and those were all included in the claims. About a month later, the initial estimate for treatment was submitted to the adjusters from my conservator. What followed were discussions, some call them disagreements, as to what would be covered and what wouldn't be covered. And this lasted through January of 2013, so about 2 months after landfall. And at the end of January 2013, all parties agreed upon the necessary funds and everything. A check was paid and work proceeded. Actually, work was already proceeding, but I'll get to that in a second. And about 11 months after the whole thing went down, all the work had been treated. And I'm happy to say that there were zero losses in this scenario. So just a couple things to talk about the actual claims process. And some of it's coming from my point of view, and some of it's coming from my conservator's point of view, because I was leaning on her for a lot of feedback as well. I felt that the communications between the phone tree that I talked about that was established and the communications between all the parties was excellent. I mean, there were people on the phone, and everybody wanted to have everybody on the phone, basically, because everybody's priorities were their biggest priorities, obviously, take care of us, please. And it was the responses were very quick to that effect too. So I felt like communication between both internally in the museum and also with our claims adjusters and all the other parties were fluid. And to touch on what again Heather and Rebecca mentioned said yesterday, establishing those relationships early was key in this whole situation. And again, most of them are already in place. And we did develop some new ones. There was some silver linings in all of this. Like the art handlers that I use now, the contract art handlers came to me from Sandy, and I've never used them before Sandy. So basically, now I have a great group of people who basically we all sort of lived through this as well, and I can lean on them for more work. Some of the minuses in the claims process, and I tried to shorten my list from my conservator down. And I edited out all the explicatives as well. Understandably, some of the people, like adjusters, they wanted needed answers quickly. And we, as collection specialists and working with conservators, we like to circle on objects, you know, a couple times before we can kind of come up with to make the best decision in order to proceed. I mean, nobody wants to make a decision in haste. Coming up with an estimated treatment cost number to repair was very difficult, and we sent a variety of mediums to the conservator. There was galvanized steel, there was plasticine, there was wood, there was ceramics. I mean, it was all across the board. So a hurried rush to establish a number that conservation would need based on a quick surface check could be prove very troublesome, obviously, and it could hurt up hurting my budget line as well. Because if it's not covered in the claim, then it's my conservation budget is obviously going to take a hit. Not that we can or need to be a part, but it is very frustrating to sit idle while vendors and adjusters sort of hash it out back and forth about what an agreed upon value of sorts. That was probably the most painful thing from my point of view, the time between that. It would have been better in my mind. This might be pie in the sky. Again, maybe not realistic to have an estimated the project stage by stage, and I know Leslie Gatt, my conservator, agrees with me on that. For example, like the metal pieces could have been taken to her lab, washed, let dried, and then revisited to see actually what can be done to properly treat them. So it was easy for adjusters, though, to request from our conservator a lower price, because at the time of the agreement, the agreed-upon money, Leslie had already started treating these things. And it's going to, like any one of us here know, nobody wants to sit idle for a month waiting for something to get agreed upon when they can clearly start treating it. So that's what, and Leslie, I know this, she didn't want to let us down, because we've worked with her for a very long time. And I know she didn't want to sit there and watch and idly wait as well. And the last thing she wanted me to mention too is like she could have used more money. Of course. So the one thing I wanted to mention in terms of the process, the claims process, from my point of view, if you've gone through it, I mean, it's not going to be anything new. To teach yourself to be patient, and you need patience to teach yourself patience sometimes. Again, making the connections with your brokers and your insurance people. I've always tried to schedule on-site visits to walk through, because I may feel like I've seen my storage rooms and I know everything that's a problem, but a fresh pair of eyes in the situation never hurts. They can always pick out something that I'm missing. And last but not least, always ask. I ask a lot of dumb questions to my insurance people, and I say just keep asking the dumb questions, basically. So that's the quick claims from post Sandy, and I'm going to introduce Mr. Stephen Pincus now. Should I wait on this one?
Yeah.
He's going to go to the questions thing next, right?
Yeah, well, I have a little something to say.
Okay. Should I? I'll just wait.
Yeah, I'll leave that. That's
good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here today. I'm Steve Pincus from New York. I work with Emily, my colleague at DeWitt Stern. So, pretty intriguing. So what's the Sandy in your area? What could that possibly be? Right, I think it's really an important point to think about it, because as bad as Sandy was, what it really did was really stretch the infrastructure. How many restorers are there? How many packer, shipper, truckers are available? And when you know what hits the fan, you want your institution to be first in line, but are you going to be first in line? Think about that. So, you know, whether you're in the Midwest or Pacific Northwest or wherever it is, you really need to kind of think about that and create, you know, that disaster plan that's been talked about here today and in other sessions. It's like, what does that really mean for you? So, you know, do you have a packer shipper lined up that is on retainer, for instance? You know, those kinds of things. Who are the restorers in your area? Are there generators and water pumps to pump out basements? If you have to go find it when everyone else is looking for it, it's going to be very difficult to get. So just really practical nuts and bolts things are so important and can help minimize your risk and save your collections. So I just want you to think about that. So those were really, to me, they keep hitting home. And yeah, it's only been 3 years since Sandy. So you know, the question really is, what is a Sandy for you? So risk from every angle, right? You deal with collections all the time. That's your life, right? The objects. So, you know, we talk about performance pieces. So that kind of gets away from an object a little bit, and it's like, do you have that happening? So what are the issues around that? They kind of come over into the liability area. Somebody could get hurt. But is it covered? Are there any exclusions on your liability insurance policy that might exclude that? Something to think about. You know, the touch points in art handling and training, storage, install, packing, shipping, conservation, exhibits, borrow property, loan property, indoor-outdoor exhibitions, public space. So these are things where obviously you need to think about every day. What are the risks from every angle? Museum liability insurance. So typically what we explain to folks is, again, to keep it 101, people coming into your institution and they slip and fall and they bring a lawsuit. That's pretty simple. Okay? But how about the work of art that you lend that's a sculpture, and now it's on an exhibition, and it falls over and it hurts somebody, but you own it. Are you going to be brought into that lawsuit? Yeah, but we didn't install it. We lent it to another institution. Or maybe you put it into a benefactor's home for a party. No one does that. No one gets asked to do that. This, benefactors are good for one thing, right? Write the check, please. But they ask for a lot. Does a benefactor ask to have a work of art that they owned conserved by the institution if you have a conservation lab? Yes? What's your liability there if you damage it? That's a professional liability. That's not a slip and fall liability kind of coverage. So does your institution carry that kind of coverage? Something to think about. We talked about, Dara, you talked about someone getting hurt carrying something. So there's workers' comp issues. So does OSHA get involved in how to handle certain objects? What's the right way, wrong way to do that? Does your institution publish any catalogs? So is there a media liability exposure that you may have if someone says something about either someone else or doesn't quite get something right and is now sued by a third party because it's wrong? Lawyers are involved everywhere. And how about those benefactors and donors? Now you're doing a new capital campaign because no institutions are expanding these days, right? So you're doing major capital campaign, and now you've got personally identifiable information in your systems. And so this whole issue of cyber attack, you hear it every day. Every company, the United States government, has been hacked. And people were looking for easy ways to get in and steal personal identifiable information. First name, last name, social security number, credit card numbers. So if you've got that in your systems, and some of the donors that you work with are obviously very high-profile people, wealthy people, and wouldn't take kindly to having their identification hacked. There's a liability, again, that the museum may have, the institution may have. Another angle of risk. So, a lot to think about. We have a few minutes left, and I thought we would open it up to questions, because I'm sure no one has any questions. So I think there's a microphone up here.
Hello. I have a question about total limits for a policy. Obviously, I don't know about everybody else, but sometimes insuring for 100% of the appraised value of your collection is impossible for some people's budgets. If not all budgets, and so I was wondering if the insurance professionals could speak to mitigating your insurance needs with budgets based on your overall collection valuation.
I'm going to take that one?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, well, there's always a balance between how much insurance you can afford to buy versus how much you have exposed, right? So that's a very typical thing. Ways to do that are to try and spread the risk of your collection. So do you have it all in one place? Are there external storage that you can sort of spread the risk of your collection? And then let's look at the highest value of anyone, either building or if the building itself, you can sort of compartmentalize where you have your collection within your building and perhaps look at a probable maximum type of loss scenario. So there are ways to look at that situation and then try to buy a limit that's within your budget to take care of, what might occur, what probably might occur, right?
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about getting and requesting certificates of insurance for things that are loaned to other institutions. You have a high-priced item going out. Is this important to get? I've gotten them before, but just wondering if you could explain that a little bit more about getting those separate certificate of insurance, if it's separate from the insurance of the borrower, or if it's, I'm curious.
Okay, so the question was about certificates of insurance. So a certificate of insurance evidences someone else's insurance, what they have. So a certificate of insurance could be issued for property. I evidence that I have this insurance to protect this property under these terms and conditions. It could be issued for general liability. I evidence that I have general liability, that if somebody slips and falls on my premises, I have the correct insurance up to X amount to cover that lawsuit in the connection with that slip and fall. So that's what a certificate of insurance does. When loaning out to another institution, that the loan agreement, the contract between you and the borrower really becomes very important. And Emily kind of touched on it before in terms of making sure, especially as the borrower, that your insurance aligns with the terms and conditions of that loan agreement. Because if you're signing and becoming liable by contract for something greater than what your insurance policy will cover, there's a miss. And that gap is on you. And that's what you don't want to have. So certificates of insurance are important because they evidence coverage. And if you're not quite sure what that it's evidencing, then you need to ask for more information, like maybe a copy of the insurance policy for which that is evidencing. Have your broker review that with you to make sure that there's no miss. It's a good question.
I want to ask whether how many, most, what the commonly acceptable form. Does all of the common fine arts insurance, Allworth Marine, deal with staff malfeasance? And is this something that one has to look out for or request that it be covered? I'm not talking about conservation, but I'm talking about if somebody just basically screws up.
Okay, so there is no screw-up exclusion in the insurance policy.
Okay.
Thank goodness for that, right? There's no screw-up insurance exclusion in the insurance policy. And so people make mistakes. Art gets handled, it gets mishandled. Maybe upon understanding how a claim occurred, maybe it didn't quite get packed the way it should have or could have. And so we learn from our mistakes. But fortunately, there's coverage for that. No, it's included. Again, the policy is an all risk, a physical loss or damage, except for what is excluded. So really understand what you have, look at your exclusions on your policy. And if it's not excluded and you have an all risk policy, we have time for maybe one more question?
One more.
Yeah. Love waivers of subrogation. In 100 words or less, okay. as an institution, the institution can waive its rights of subrogation. The key is, can you waive your insurance carrier's rights of subrogation? It's because if you have a loss, your insurance carrier, if it's covered under your policy, is going to pay that loss. They're going to look around to see who's the guilty party, who else can I go after to recoup my claim that I paid to you, right? So that's the rub. You can waive your rights, but can you waive your insurance carrier's rights to subrogate? You can get that prior to a loss, okay? But you have to make sure you have your, not only are you agreeing to it, but that your insurance carrier covering you is agreeing to that waiver. And that's what you need to get in order to make it an ironclad waiver.
What insurance company would agree to that, though?
All of them. Typically, yeah, it's not uncommon.
Can you give an example of that stated?
Well, the insurance company, you would get the waiver from the insurance carrier themselves, right? By certificate of insurance or by policy endorsement. So that would be the evidence of that. Okay? So talk to your broker about that. I don't know if that was 100 words or less, but it's pretty close. I want to thank everyone for filling this room. You guys were really fantastic and a great panel, a really great panel.